This week, South African voters are preparing for one of the most consequential elections in the nation's history. What do they want for the future of their country? After 30 years in power, has the ruling African National Congress created a better life for all? We'll discuss the ANC's politics, policies, and promises. We'll also look at a new bill in the U.S. Congress that seeks to review ties between the United States and South Africa. Straight Talk Africa starts now. Hello there and a warm welcome to Straight Talk Africa. We're coming to you from VOA's headquarters in Washington. I'm Hayley Adams. It is so great to be with you. Is South Africa on the brink of a major political turning point? And could the African National Congress, which has ruled that country for all of its 30 years of democracy, lose its majority for the first time since the end of apartheid? Analysts predict the May 29th general election could redefine and reshape the country's political landscape for generations to come. The ANC is, of course, Africa's oldest liberation movement. It has long been almost untouchable in South African politics, at one point commanding around 70% of the vote. But the party of Nelson Mandela, the movement that spearheaded the fight to end apartheid, has seen a gradual decline in support in recent years. And this week, we'll take a closer look at the ANC's politics, its policies, and its promise to create a better life for all South Africans. Now, let's go to South Africa, where Ziyanda Ngobo is standing by for us. She's a political reporter for VOA's affiliate news station, Newsroom Africa, and she joins me now from Johannesburg. Ziyanda, what a pleasure to have you on the show. Look, these are heady days as we head into a pivotal election for South Africa. To help our viewers understand what the most pressing issues are that will drive voters to the polls this election cycle.
Thank you so much for having me, Heidi. Definitely, it's an interesting election. Many will tell you that it's difficult to call because of just how many issues are now being faced by South Africans. Key amongst them is the high unemployment levels amongst the youth. Now, they are the biggest targets of political parties going into these elections because the apathy of young people in South Africa has been noted. But also for the newly formed political parties, they are trying to tap into a market that is not holding on to the sentiment of the African National Congress being a liberation movement. Our energy crisis also remains at the top of the agenda, but also general service delivery issues that are plaguing our municipalities across the country. There has been a degradation and a debilitation of, services. So these are the issues that political parties are trying to target, but certainly young people, the unemployed, though some of them even, educated and graduated that are sitting at home, are the key targets for this election.
Ziyanda, as you alluded to, one of the most interesting elements of this election is the rise of opposition parties. Who are the most formidable parties vying for votes this cycle? And do they have a real chance of giving the ANC a run for its money, especially in terms of just the ANC's inevitability of, gaining a majority once again?
Yeah, certainly. So the ANC going into this election is fully aware that it is in a danger zone and that it could actually decline below the 50% to have that majority that's needed to govern alone and not enter into a coalition government. And what this has meant is that there are now over 350 registered political parties, over 55 that are going to be on the ballot. Now, this many have too many options. You don't know what to choose, and you go back to your a la carte menu. That's what some analysts here have said, that this may actually push voters back to voting for what they know. But what we've seen in particular is another escalation of factionalism within the governing ANC, where the newly formed Umkhonto we Sizwe Party, which is now was first endorsed and now being led by former ANC President Jacob Zuma is posing a threat to the African National Congress in key provinces such as KwaZulu-Natal and Gauteng. KwaZulu-Natal is the stronghold of Zuma, but also the biggest voting bloc of the ANC. Both these provinces combined contribute the Umkhonto we Sizwe party is posing as a real threat. We've seen recent court challenges brought by the ANC against Umkhonto we Sizwe, firstly against the registration of the party, but also secondly when dealing with the logo that is being used. Now, you remember that Umkhonto we Sizwe was the military wing of the ANC, and they are saying that this is a part of their legacy and Zuma has stolen what actually belongs to them. And so this has been one of the key parties that looks set to actually shake up what happens post the 29th of May when we go to the polls. But certainly issues-based kind of approach is what most parties are trying to grapple with.
And it is, of course, not the first time that the ANC has seen some of its most formidable threats being born from within the party itself, as we saw, of course, with the case of what is now the EFF. Ziyanda, we talked earlier about South Africa's young voters. Let's expand a little on that. What's driving them to the polls, and how do they view the movement that liberated the country? Many of them, of course, part of the Born Frees, who were born after or in 1994. Which parties, which platforms appear to resonate most with young black voters?
It's a very interesting question that you ask, and I think it's very nuanced, and I'll try to be as nuanced as possible in my response, because in the first instance, I think there is an acknowledgement across the board from the newly formed and the old political parties that getting young people out there to vote and dealing with the voter apathy is at the top of the agenda. And now when you talk to the black voter, as you'll know, they're not a monolithic group. And so they have very different issues because South Africa still largely remains divided along racial lines and who has access to what in terms of resources. So someone who's living in a suburban area may have a different need or want from a particular party as opposed to someone who's living in a rural area who doesn't have basic needs such as.
We seem to have some problems there with Ziyanda Ngoba's connection. We'll try and get back to her, if possible, a little later on. But let's move on here. But that was Ziyanda Ngoba from VOA affiliate station Newsroom Africa speaking to me there from Johannesburg. Let's take a short break here. And when Straight Talk Africa returns, amid major foreign policy disagreements over the wars in Ukraine and Gaza, we'll look at the shape of relations between the United States and its largest trading partner on the African continent, South Africa. This is Straight Talk Africa on the Voice of America. Stay with us. We're back in a moment.
In times of change, when the world seems uncertain, and what we hear doesn't reflect what we see, we seek the truth. When we are told only part of the story, we lose trust. In moments of crisis, our dreams, hopes, and wishes for a better tomorrow depend on a free press. At Voice of America, we bring you the stories that people take risks to see. We connect the world and unite it with truth. At Voice of America, we show you the whole picture.
According to World Economic Forum, an estimated 100 million people in Africa suffer from clinical depression, and 66 million of them are women. On this week's edition of Our Voices, we'll seek to understand more about depression, which has been described as the most prevalent mental illness in the world. We'll also speak with experts on how depression is treated. Join the conversation each week, right here on Our Voices.
You're watching VOA's Red Carpet. My name is Jackson Vunganyi. Thank you so much for joining us each week right here on Red Carpet. We bring you the latest in...
You're with Straight Talk Africa. Welcome back. Two recent commentary pieces in two major news publications, one American and one South African, are giving us a glimpse into the state of the relationship between South Africa and the United States. Just over a week ago, U.S. Congressman John James, who heads the Subcommittee on Africa of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, wrote a hard-hitting op-ed in South Africa's Daily Maverick news publication, in which the congressman criticized what he called Pretoria's alignment with countries like Iran, Russia, and China. Well, soon after, South African President Cyril Ramaphosa penned an op-ed in the Washington Post in which Mr. Ramaphosa refused to back down from what he called South Africa's non-aligned independent foreign policy. The political schism comes as the U.S. House of Representatives debates a bill on the bilateral relationship between South Africa and the United States. Well, joining me now in studio is Calvin Dark. He's a political analyst and the president of RC Communications, and joining me from Cape Town, South Africa, is Sanusha Naidu. She's a foreign policy analyst with the Institute for Global Dialogue. Sanusha and Calvin, a warm welcome to both of you. Before we get started here, I want to read some excerpts from each opinion piece. Now, this, we're going to pull up a graphic here. This is from Congressman John James. He says, "I acknowledge that improvements are needed in our diplomatic engagement to address the challenges of this century and to safeguard our shared future. But the American people will not be played for fools. So again, while the United States deeply respects South Africa's sovereignty and its right to determine its own domestic and foreign policy, it is also essential to recognize that actions have consequences and that the American people have choices too." This then from President Cyril Ramaphosa of South Africa. He said, "South Africans remember the great support the American people gave us during our struggle for democracy. South Africa is today home to more than 600 U.S. companies, and the United States is the second largest destination for South African exports. Some of South Africa's largest companies have made significant investments in key economic sectors in the United States. We do not accept that our non-aligned position favors Russia above other countries, nor do we accept that it imperils our relations with other countries." And Sanusha, I want to kick things off here with you. What do the tone and tenor of these op-eds tell you about the state of the relationship between South Africa and the United States right now?
Good day, Haley, and good day to your guest. It's lovely to be on the show again. But I think it really talks to the kind of tenuous relationship that the tone takes on. It's hard-hitting. Both the president and the U.S. representative, John James, also, you know, what's coming out very clearly is that there are non-negotiable spaces, that there's a sense that South Africa has not necessarily done what it should be doing in terms of keeping to the idea that it's making these statements, it's kind of moving into a direction, whether it's in the BRICS or outside of the BRICS, is that it's taking on a position and it doesn't really sit very well with Washington at the moment. And there was a delegation out from Washington coming to South Africa and other way to other places in Africa to talk about the relationship broadly between South Africa and the U.S., but also in a more broad context of the relationship that the U.S. has with the African continent. And I think what's really coming out now is a sense that there's a level of agency, there's a level of voice that perhaps President Ramaphosa in his Washington Post op-ed, and he also did it in his weekly note to the ANC,
and to the nation, he actually made this very state statements. It is a lot that you can pick out from there that talks about, you know, our voice of independence, our agency. And I think what's happening in the context of Washington, it's actually finding it to be difficult in a sense to push South Africa. So when you listen, when you read the op-ed by the U.S. representative, you pick up that it's coming from the tone of what is happening in the domestic political environment around opposition parties. Just today, one of the opposition parties that's registered to vote in the next, in the upcoming election, wrote a very kind of hard-hitting piece about South Africa's foreign policy going rogue. But it's all based on the idea of how do you attract the kind of narrative you want. And I think that's what's happening, is that they're not talking to each other. They're talking past each other, and it's becoming much more conflictual with the war of words. And I think the last point I want to make here is that we're beginning to see in this narrative also the geopoliticization of the global order, and that sometimes you have to follow a particular way. And if you don't follow that way, then you get called out. But it doesn't mean that the people who are calling you out can claim the moral high ground either.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, always the question of whose morality. And we see here this sort of op-ed diplomacy going on here. But Calvin, of course, part of what's under discussion here is this U.S.-South Africa Bilateral Relations Review Act. Can you help our viewers and listeners understand what exactly is the United States reviewing here?
Well, on paper, I think they're reviewing the relationships that our allies like South Africa have with our adversaries like China and Russia. But if you want to simplify that, it's a review of loyalty. I think the message behind this legislative attempt is that America can use its influence and partnerships to exert its influence around the world. In other words, partnership with the United States has a price. Now, that is incredibly arrogant, but also incredibly true when you think about how America does its foreign policy. And the consequence of that is we're able to manipulate our allies' foreign policy, but we really don't have allies. A negative consequence is we just have countries that are partners until they find a better option to where they don't have to exist with us. Hashtag BRICS, okay? And so I think in sum, this legislative attempt is to show South Africa and the world America's relationships have strings. And if you don't like the strings, you don't get to be in the club.
Sanusha, does belonging to the club, as Calvin had said, and sort of the U.S.-South Africa Bilateral Relations Review Act, does it bother the South African government? I mean, are they worried about potential changes that could be on the horizon here, changes in ties and changes that might not necessarily be in South Africa's advantage or South Africa's financial advantage?
To Minister Pandor when she was in Washington a week or two ago, and she spoke to, I think it was at the Carnegie Endowment for Peace, and this was a similar question or a question in the same context raised, and she said that they do consider this relationship very strategic, very important, and I think any country in the world will actually be concerned about how this relationship evolves. So I think in the context of where it is right now, there is consideration within the South African government. You wouldn't necessarily have President Ramaphosa writing this weekly note in his ANC newsletter on this relationship, because it's really important. But I think it's also about the fact that it's a concern that extends beyond just, and I think Calvin put it very nicely when he said it's a bilateral review of loyalty. It extends beyond just this bilateral review. I think it's also about what happens in the U.S. context in its own presidential elections later this year, and what will be the U.S. foreign policy going forward thereafter. And it does have implications and ramifications, not just for South Africa, but I think for the broader continent, Southern Africa and the continental context, because of the impact that the trade dynamics will unfold in the context of what the outcome would be. Would it be a Biden presidency again, or would we see a Trump presidency? These are all narratives that are coming around and definitely being discussed. But in South Africa, in its domestic constituency, I think where this, a lot of the narrative is being fueled on the lines of we should really now be heeding to what U.S. is warning us about this bilateral relationship, comes out of the opposition and parts of civil society, etc. I think in government there is also this reaction that we can't let this be told what to do. We are a sovereign state. But if you read the op-ed piece by the U.S. representative, he talks about the narrative out of civil society and opposition party. And I think that, again, is also misleading in a sense, because I think there's also political posturing by opposition parties and certain members of civil society in order to how they want to posture towards the U.S. as well. And we know that the official opposition had written to Secretary of State Anthony Blinken asking for observers to come to observe our elections. And that caused also not a very good taste, and it was very seen as very distasteful in the context of where we are in our own election.
Calvin, this relationship just feels like it keeps getting worse and not better. Do you think the differences in foreign policy and sort of the deterioration of ties, and as Sanusha was saying, people are now speaking past each other, are these all challenges in the relationship that can actually be overcome?
I think they can, but I think that's mostly going to be on South Africa's end. I say that because we often associate America First, for example, with Republicans and Donald Trump. And we know that that will be the lane if the Republicans win. But it's also the Democrats. The only difference, America First, but not alone, I think is what they always say. So in essence, as the world gets a little bit more complicated, Americans from Democrat to Republican independent want clear partnerships with countries that agree with them on issues like with Russia, China, with Israel. And I don't see the U.S. moving from that, because I think most Americans see that as if they want to be with us, they've got to be with us, to harken back to George W. Bush.
Right. Mm-hmm. You're either with us or against us here. Sanusha, it's relatively clear what South Africa gives to this relationship with the U.S. and what it gets out of this relationship, especially in terms of bilateral trade, for example. But what does South Africa get out of its relationships with Russia, Iran, and China? And is it comparable with what it gets out of the relationship with the United States?
Well, I think there are different elements to the relationship between the U.S. Versus China, Russia, and so forth. I think in the context of the Russia-China context, I think it goes back to that historical narrative. It goes back to the question of Bongdung, non-alignment, the question of the developing world, which now we call the Global South. And it's that solidarity, that mutual level of engagement, etc., where you kind of opening up the space and saying that in the Global South we have this elevation of voice. I think you can even include India there. I'm quite fascinated that India is not considered to be one of those countries that don't necessarily, are seen as not necessarily a country that is against the values of the U.S. They all seem to be those democracies that come together. But if you look domestically, what's going on in India, you should raise these questions around that level of democratic value and what's going on domestically in its own political landscape. So I think those are the dynamics. I think with the U.S., it's really around understanding the level of engagement around the commercial diplomacy, the economic diplomacy, but also now the political diplomacy. Because at the end of the day, I think one of the things we've got to be very, very mindful of is that within Africa and within the broader context of the world order and the global context that we find ourselves in, is that you cannot afford to go in and try to raise this attitude that you have to choose who you want to be an ally and who you don't want to be an ally in your domestic affairs or your foreign policy affairs, because it also raises the question around how this isolates the country that's claiming, we need to review your bilateral relationship. In essence, you've got countries now that may say, yes, review it, but then we got bilateral relations with other countries. So it's not so clear-cut, and it's no longer that kind of world that existed in the Cold War or even existed in the period after 1990. We're very fluid. It's an unpredictable world order, and you cannot afford to isolate yourself. But this is one of the fears, I think, and the narratives that are coming out in terms of what's happening in the context of who actually underwrites this world order.
Speaking of a changing world order, Calvin, Is it the United States that is perhaps behind the times here when it comes to a changing world order? Why is South Africa's relationship with Iran, China and Russia specifically? Because Sunusha just highlighted India doesn't seem to be a problem, neither Turkey or a number of other countries here. But why is it those three countries, which granted are America's rivals, but why is it such a sticking point that the U.S. is not willing to budge? And why is it such a hard pill for the United States to swallow?
I think because for the first time, I would say over the last 10 years, we realize that against China alone, against Russia alone, against Iran alone, they're a threat, but America's got it, so to speak. If they get together, it's going to be a little bit tougher. And I think there's a real fear with that. That's why it's no coincidence that in Congress, the only things Congress can agree on are things that affect China or affect our relations with our adversaries, because there is this fear that we are losing the grip that we've had, that we've always known. The difference in policy is, do we loosen that grip without losing our advantage, which I think is what a lot of Democrats want to do, or do we play hardball, which is what a lot of Republicans want to do? And frankly, that is a little bit more popular on the streets of America.
Indeed, these are all fascinating conversations, and I really do appreciate your insights here. This conversation just gets more and more interesting as both countries have elections going on. Sunusha, you actually mentioned on the show not too many weeks ago that, you know, the controversial parts of South Africa's foreign policy does seem to have become a centerpiece of domestic politics, especially with the election coming up. Has South Africa's foreign policy really helped it in the run-up to the election, and could it help the party at the ballot box?
The short answer here is no. Foreign policy is not a key issue in our election space. It's not something that political parties especially have put out as a foreign policy issue that drives the electoral process going forward, the campaigning. Now, unlike, for example, what you're seeing in the U.S. now around the primaries with the Democrats and so forth around the question of Israel and groups, minority groups like the Arab Americans not voting or saying not non-committal. So I think this, it's not necessarily that. In South Africa, it doesn't play that level of domestication in our elections. It's really the issues that Zianda put forward in terms of crime, in terms of resources, in terms of unemployment, etc.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there, Sunusha Naidoo and Calvin Dark. I do appreciate your insights and your time. Well, today is my last day here on Straight Talk Africa as my time here at the Voice of America comes to a close. And I will begin now a new chapter in my career, but I leave you in very, very good hands. I want to say a special thank you to my colleagues who have worked so hard behind the scenes, our reporters in the field across Africa and here in the United States who have contributed to the show, all the many, many people like Calvin Dark, Sunusha Naidoo, who have come onto the show, shared their insights, their ideas. I appreciate it so much. It has been an honor for me to work with a stellar production team, my colleagues Keith Wallace, Zoe Liudahi, and Karina Chowdhury, and many, many others, as well as our technical teams in the control room. I thank you, and I appreciate all of you. And to you, of course, our viewers and our listeners, thank you for always watching. Thank you for always listening. And so, as we say in South Africa, Hamba kahle, salaka kuhle, laat het goed gaan, go well, goodbye.